All right, this week's Parsha is Parsha's Toldot, and it deals with this is the main Parsha, which tells the story of Yitzchak. This is Yitzchak's Parsha. We're going to get into it. There's so much stuff. I will just make reference. This is our fourth cycle, so I think I have three other classes on Toldot. So I try to deal with different topics because both Sean and Suzanne have been with me for all three other years, so I have to have new stuff. So I don't want to repeat anything. So check out at yutera.org. You can filter, go by my name, and put in Toldot if you want to hear other classes on Toldot. All right, let's get to the video. Obviously, we like to do a video. Okay. Let me share a screen, and here we go.
Hey, Pop, can I ask you a question? How come you ain't never liked me? Like you? What law is there say I got to like you? All right, don't you eat every day? Answer me when I talk to you. Don't you eat every day?
Yeah.
As long as you're in my house, you put a sir on the end of it when you talk to me.
Yes, sir.
You eat every day. Yes, sir. Got a roof over your head.
Yes, sir.
Got clothes on your back.
Yes, sir.
Why do you think that is?
Because of you.
Hell, I know it's because of me. But why do you think that is?
Because you like me.
Like you. I go out of here every morning. I bust my butt because I like you. You're like the biggest fool I ever saw. A man is supposed to take care of his family. You live in my house, fill your belly with my food, put you behind on my bed because you're my son. It's my duty to take care of you. I owe a responsibility to you. I ain't got to like you. I don't give you everything I got to give you. I give you your life. Me and your mama worked that out. Between us, and liking your black ass wasn't part of the bargain. Now don't you go through life worrying about whether somebody likes you or not. You best be making sure that they're doing right by you. You understand what I'm saying?
Everything that boy do, he do for you.
It's not easy for me to admit that I've been standing in the same place for 18 years.
Well, I've been standing with you. I get 18 years of my life to stand in the same spot as you.
All right, pretty intense. All right. Did everybody see the movie Fences? Raise your hand if you've seen it. Nobody saw it?
Never saw it.
Okay, I will summarize it. Okay, so look at here. I got a little summary over here. Denzel Washington directed and stars in this adaptation of August Wilson's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, which centers on a black garbage collector named Troy Maxson in 1950 Pittsburgh. Bitter about baseball's color barrier was only broken after his own heyday in the Negro Leagues. Maxson is posed to taking out his frustration on his loved one. I start with question number one. How does... Why does Troy speak harshly to Corey? I mean, you know, you guys have your basic TV and movie logic. So apply it here. I've given you a 2-minute clip and a brief Wikipedia summary. Why does Troy speak harshly to his son, Corey?
He's had a really, really hard life, and the only way he knows how to communicate with him is in that really kind of firm, hard language. He doesn't know affection or kindness or love.
Okay. So, in other words, he feels he's had a bitter life, therefore he speaks to Everly in a bitter way. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, this, yeah, exactly. I think that's a learned...
You're saying like he's raising his son the way he was raised, right?
That could also be the case. Or that's also a foreshadowing. Often, typically, people who have been raised in a very harsh manner will, in fact, raise their kids in the same harsh manner because that's what they believe is the way you raise kids.
Right.
Right. That's what they've been taught. They don't necessarily know it. No one's shown them another way to do it. So it's hard to...
That's all he knows.
Right. It's hard to teach yourself that without a little bit of guidance. And so that's all he knows.
Okay. Now, that goes that, which is a perfect segue into question number two. Suzanne, in what way is lashing out at Corey a coping mechanism for Troy?
Well, he can't treat other people like that. So he's a good kind of whipping boy for him.
Right. In other words, he's frustrated because he was excellent as a baseball player in the 1940s, and he was limited because he could only play in the Negro Leagues, and until Jackie Robinson opened up the blacks into the professional baseball leagues of America. So he's an angry guy because he feels that his life is sort of like sad and pathetic. So therefore, he can't yell at his boss, he'll get fired. You know, he can't. So his son, who is his subject, he can, smack him or speak to him in an aggressive way. Which, of course, gets in question number three, Sean. What does Troy's use of this coping mechanism do to the relationship between Corey and Troy? And this is without you seeing the totality of the movie.
Well, it destroys their relationship.
Why?
Because because Corey probably thinks that Troy is not treating him fairly.
Well, he knows. Just because the father's had a rough life and he's angry about it, and he will then, in fact, yell at the kid. The kid knows that it's unjust. Now, of course, gets into question number four. Adrian, why is the fact that Troy does right by him, which he calls by feeding him and clothing him and having a roof over his head and taking care of him, insufficient for Corey?
Because man does not live from bread alone, especially when it comes to your parents. You seek your father to be a figure of support, not just for physical necessities, but also that's an emotional support, someone to guide you and mentor you through life.
100% correct. 100%. The fact that he takes care of his basic physical needs, if you go through Maslow's basic hierarchy of needs, that might take care of 1, 2, 3, but the basic love to be of love and affection and to be validated and et cetera, all these different basic needs, not even to be educated, to have a meaning and a spiritual need and intellectual need. It's his fundamental humanity is not being addressed.
But I do want to point out that I think that, I mean, in between parents and mothers, parents do tend to be a little more dry and a little more removed from their children than their mother. So I don't know if there's something to that.
No, that's a normal thing. The mother might play the more nurturing role, while the father might play a more role of discipline and creating firm boundaries and providing clear instruction. But we're going to get to that. We're going to hold on to that question, that little piece we're going to get to. Question number five, let me hear from, I'm going to pick on somebody, Karen, obviously. What lesson can we draw for ourselves about the right way for a father to deal with his own baggage when it comes to his relationship with the children?
That he has to deal with his own baggage personally, or else it could be really destructive to the relationship. I hate the word unfair, but it's a bit unfair, and it could come between the relationship.
100% correct. In other words, that's really what mentioned earlier by Shmuel, is that let's say a person has a hard life. Let's say a person has a lot of emotional issues, okay? But the truth is, that's not the kid's fault. You brought the kid into the world. You have a responsibility to nourish the kid, raise the kid properly, and the fact that you have difficult issues, well, that, you know, then you need to work that out with a therapist, with a counselor. You know what I'm saying? You don't have to act out your dissatisfactions, you know, the proverbial kicking the dog, you know, metaphor. Not really, Suzanne, don't worry. Only by metaphor, only. You should not take it on your kids. Now, by the way, that this one point right here is the hardest thing in parenting. Why do parents, if you ask parents, do you act out or share your baggage with your kids? What do most parents would say?
Yeah. Yes.
They would admit to it.
Well, probably no, but they probably do.
Right. So I think you brought up the point. So most parents do act out. In other words, if their parent was very permissive, then they're going to be super strict. If their parents were super strict, then they're going to be super permissive. You know what I'm saying? They're becoming like just a reaction formation, just doing the opposite of what the parent did and not really thinking through what's best for the child at that time. Most people are psychologically unaware of their own emotions, A. B. And they're certainly, and they're not aware of their emotional needs with the kids. C, they don't really understand what the kids really need at their various stages of development. And therefore, they act inappropriately psychologically with their kids. And their kids, by the way, suffer because of that. Here's a good question, and I'm going to turn back to Shmuel again. But I might call him Scott, so hold on, Scott. I want to hear you also. Two people on this question. What is the difference between acting out and tough love? Shmuel.
I'm not actually sure I understand the question.
In other words, in the clip, Troy was yelling at Corey. Was that an acting out or was that a tough love? Now, you're hampered because you didn't see the immediate scene before that. But just explain your answer enough that it makes no difference. Just using it. You saw that Denzel Washington, a.k.a. Troy, was getting up into his son's grill. Was that an acting out or was that a showing of tough love?
No, it was tough love.
I'm going to say it was acting out because maybe before this scene, like, the son said something and did something like.
But remember, what did the son ask the question to the father?
Why do you give me these things?
No.
He's like, why aren't you nice to me or why don't you love me or something like
why
that?
Why don't you like me?
Yeah, why don't you like me?
If your kid asks you that question, you're in bad shape. Now, he didn't double down and say, I know I do like you. I may not show it all the time, which might have been the therapeutically appropriate answer. He says, what law says that I got to like you? All right? You know, and he made the case that, in fact, him being basically withdrawing or not showing any love, and rather, he basically says, I'm doing right by you. The basic thing is the responsibility. I am responsible up to you. I don't love you. Now, those both can be true. You have, yes, you have a responsibility to your child, but you should also treat your child with affection so the child will know that. So this is so what are the difference between acting out and tough love?
Is there acting out is like, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, this makes me think of like Rabbi Twersky because of his psychiatric practice, and we see this a lot when we have to deal with like drug addicted patients and having their parents cut them off financially, and they're like, oh no, that's tough love because you know that the money will be spent for drugs. Acting out is screaming and having a temper tantrum when the kid goes out and does something bad, but not, you know, kind of doing something that's difficult, but in the best interest of the child or of the patient.
Exactly. Tough love is a function of acting in a firm, assertive, even aggressive manner based upon a well thought out plan. Acting out is, I am frustrated, therefore I yell at my kid. The kid is merely a trigger for my own emotional eruption. You know what I'm saying? I may cover for that by saying that what? I am really trying to parent the child. You know what I'm saying? But in reality, is it an acting out? Am I doing which is truly, am I just venting my emotions? Or am I doing what's best for the raising of this child? You know what I'm saying? Is that difference clear? Is that clear?
I think conceptually it's clear. In practice, probably not so clear.
Well, what makes it even more murky is that sometimes you can do the exact same action. One time the motivation is that this is clearly a function of a well thought out plan versus it's just an impulsive reaction to the kid. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So the motivation and the thought process before is really the critical piece. All right. This is relevant to our, okay, let's take a look here. All right. I'm going to start with the first pasuk of the Parsha. Let me have Ina. Can you see it? Do I have Dan on the line? Do I have Dan, last one on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Can you see the sheet?
Yeah. From 19. This is the history of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac.
No, that's it. Isaac. That's it. So this is the first pasuk of the Parsha. What any obvious questions about the Parsha, about this first pasuk, insofar as its structure?
Seems redundant.
There you go, it's redundant. It says, these are the history of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son, Avram fathered Yitzchak. Well, obviously, if he's his son, he's fathered him. So that is an absolute redundancy. It's superfluous, unnecessary. Okay? So all the Mephoshim, all the classic commentators share that. All right, so Dan last, we keep on with the Radak's point. He shares two insights into this particular piece. Go on.
Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of...
No, are you reading? I'm talking about Radak, or the Radak piece.
Oh, from Radak. Abraham fathered Isaac. We are told in Baba Matzia 86 that Yitzhak's facial features were so similar to those of his father that anyone ever encountering Yitzhak immediately knew that he must be the son of Abraham. The reason that this has been arranged so by God is that when someone claims to have become a father in his old age, some people tend to doubt the father's claims, assuming that the woman who had born that child must have been unfaithful to her husband, or that at least the baby now presented as his father's was in fact a family. Yitzhak's amazing similarity that his father's precluded anyone from making such spurious accusations.
Okay, stop. So the first point is, the first thing says, and it says, these are generations of Avram, Yitzchak, Avram's son, Avram fathered Yitzchak. So the Radak brings down the Talmudic story saying, Avram followed Yitzchak, and it was evident to the eye. In other words, not only was he biologically, in fact, sharing the same DNA, but everybody could see that. Now, why was it important for everybody to see that? Why was it important that Yitzchak be a spitting image of his father?
So there'd be no doubt.
Say it again?
There'd be no doubt that he was the son?
Correct. Why is that important?
So there wouldn't be any salacious rumors.
So salacious rumors that basically that either A, they adopted this child in old age, got nothing to do with them. Or that in fact Sarah got his child with somebody else. Okay. And why is that a problem?
Well, for matters of inheritance, so that Yitzhak could say that, you know, all of his father's property was his own.
Okay, so that's from a financial standpoint. What even a more significant standpoint than even the money? And I gave a class on this last year that there was a tremendous antagonism toward Yitzchak. Why is that?
I was thinking more in terms of the covenant and the moral mantle that he's taken on from his father.
100% correct. That's the main point. That basically, if they can impugn that Yitzchak is in fact not the true son of Avram, therefore they can shut down Avram's movement. This guy's not the real deal. He's some imposter. He's a faker. He's a poser. Okay? So basically, but when they see little Yitzchak basically looking exactly like his dad, God's providence shut down that criticism. Because there's all kinds of attacks. There's all kinds of ways that people want to attack. And this is what they call leitzanut. In fact, Rashi quotes a similar idea. It says the leitzanei hador, the scoffers of the generation. Or if you can attack the person's ideas in a frontal, direct way, what way do you try to negate them?
Straw dog or a straw man or whatever.
Well, through all kinds of, false types of argumentation. Ad hominem attack the person instead of the ideas, or attack them in a way where they can't defend themselves. So they say, oh, yeah, your kid, you're 100 years old. You didn't have this kid. This kid's, you got it from the foster home. This kid's not, no, this is not your kid. You're a liar. Okay, that's point number one. Let's get to the second point, number two. Dan, continue. Dan, can you see it? You may have lost Dan. All right, Sean, read it out in the yellow.
Another reason that the Torah repeated something which we all knew, that Avraham had sired Yitzhak, was that Yitzhak possessed the same virtues and wonderful qualities which Avraham excelled in, so that it was clear who must have been his father, not only physically, but that the same father also transmitted a spiritual legacy to his son.
Okay, so what's the reason for the repetition? These are generations of Isaac, Avraham's son. Avraham fathered Yitzchak. What is being, according to the Radak, What's another reason for the redundancy, Sean?
Essentially two levels, like physically and spiritually.
Right. He basically, Yitzhak was not just simply a biological child of Avram, but he was the spiritual inheritor. He was the disciple of Avram. He was the spiritual inheritor. Excellent. This question, Rabbi Mann, one of my Rebbeim, he wrote a book, which I recommend going on Amazon, getting it, called Eternally Yours. Check it out on Amazon, on Genesis. And one of his, he asked a really great question, which I'm going to reveal to you right now. We'll get to it in a moment. I have a build-up question before that. What type of father was Avram? And how was this type of father able to be the father of many nations? Avram is called, 2 weeks ago, that he's called the father of many nations. What kind of father is that? What's the difference between the guy who's a father and the father of many nations? What does that mean? Mandel.
The father of many nations is that he wasn't just a physical progenitor of humanity to whatever degree that he was, but also that he was a father of ideas. He had a certain idea that was born out by what that created societies, or that drove societies conceptually.
Right. The basic father has to minimalistically be a role model to his children. To be good people. Yeah, Avram is the role model and father of excellence to an entire civilization. The entire Western world, to this very day, 2018, is fundamentally animated because both Judaism, Islam, and Christianity view Avram as their father, their philosophical father. Okay, now obviously there's a little bit of difference there, but Avram's impact is he's still the father of many nations already 4,000 years or 3,700 years after he walked this earth. It's amazing. Now, here's a key question. This is a little bit difficult, but I'm going to throw it out there anyways. I got this question for Ray Mann. Troy alienated his son Corey with his constant demeaning of him and squashing of his dreams. Would not Avram's attempted slaughtering of Yitzhak on the altar be even worse? How was Yitzhak able to get past Avram's binding him on the altar and become his top disciple? Remember, that, you know, like last week, there was a little bit of a, 2 weeks ago, there was a little bit of an episode called The Binding of Isaac, where Avram took his son to Mount Moriah, tied him up, put him on a bundle of wood, and lifted up a very sharp knife and was about to kill him when an angel said, "Don't kill your son Yitzchak." If you were Isaac, what would your relationship be with your dad after that?
Well, isn't there an idea that Yitzhak was like a willing participant in the whole thing?
Well, that gets to the question of how old was Yitzhak at the time of the binding?
In his 30s, right?
So the Ibn Ezra says 13. He's clearly old. The Torah does not say the age. He's got to be old enough to walk, carry the wood, which he does, and have a conversation with his dad. So the Ibn Ezra puts him at age 13. And it's got to be a guy who's old enough to be able to, that the father's able to tie him up if he's like, you know, 37 years old, as Rashi midrashically claims he is. He could have run away, and that makes really the test, not really of Avram, but really of Yitzchak.
I'm pretty sure he was Shmuel's age, actually.
Are you referring to Shmuel, your brother?
Yes.
Good. All right. So let's take the plain shot way that he's 13. I think that's a more plain shot way. Let's say you're 13 and your dad ties you up and nearly kills you on the altar in the binding of Isaac. would that be, shall we say, that would be an issue in the relationship?
There's a lot of anxiety.
Well,
like you're afraid your father is going to sacrifice you, you know, whenever he gets the idea.
All right. So Dan says that after that traumatic event, you're going to have post-traumatic stress syndrome. That every time you see your dad reaching for the steak knife, you're wondering, like, oh my God, he's doing it again. Okay. So, but not only did Yitzchak not apparently bear a grudge, but we just read from the Radak that he became his what? Top disciple. So how do you explain that? Does everybody hear the question?
But couldn't you say that if they share the same virtues, they must share somewhat of the same belief system, and it's a learned thing to believe that, or if you aspire to be someone and you're so respected to begin with. I mean, I can't imagine emotionally grappling with it, but logically, it seems like it would run course.
Okay, so you're saying that Yitzchak understood where his dad's coming from, so he views it being not in a certain sense, it's not personal.
Understood and overall respected his father, so almost even aspired to be like, if he was so virtuous to begin with, that you force yourself to accept it. I mean, it's almost like telling a mother that her son is a serial killer. She would say he was the kindest boy ever, or the kindest girl ever. You know, certain times I think that you turn a blind eye, but your brain plays tricks on you, I guess, or...
So you're saying the way that Yitzchak dealt with that, he basically was in denial about his father.
No, I think actually maybe bad example. I think more the respect aspect of it based on how they describe it, but maybe not. It doesn't look like that's the case.
All right. Shmuel, you have some comments on that?
I don't know if this is an answer to the question specifically, but my understanding is, are you asking like what the difference between the relationship with Troy and his son and...
Right, so Troy basically ruined the relationship. Ultimately, the son leaves.
Okay. So what I would tell you the difference in the very little that I know is that to me, the biggest difference between the two is that while Avraham taking Isaac to be sacrificed is undoubtedly very traumatic, I don't think it would destroy the relationship, because in situations like that, people even very, very young people can realize that there's a before and an after that traumatic event. And so I think Yitzchak would have learned very quickly that his father is not bringing him to be sacrificed every weekend. Right? Whereas with the father-son relationship in the movie, this is a lifelong situation. Like, his father dislikes him and treats him poorly every single day. And so it blurs a person's understanding of I guess, that relationship, whereas a singular traumatic event perhaps wouldn't, because there's a before and an after, and there's a moving on from it.
So I agree with you 100%. I think, Tan was also saying a similar point, is that basically context is everything. Number one, in the movie, Corey understands his father, Troy, played by Denzel Washington, is just a broken, messed up person who's incapable of having a normal, loving relationship with his son. And therefore, he has to leave. He does leave. And he goes, joins the Marines in the movie. Okay. In this context, Avraham has been teaching his son Yitzchak. He sees him to be a compassionate person. He sees him to be a profoundly wise person. He sees a person who honestly loves him in a very profound way. But he also recognized that Yitzchak also knows that he loves, that Avram loves Hashem. And therefore, in an inexplicable way, asked him to do this attempted, he didn't go through it, an attempted act. The Pasuk says, we read this on Rosh Hashanah, on the second day, it says, Vayelchu shneim yachda, they walked both of them together. On the way to the Akedah, Vayelchu shneim yachda, on the way out of the Akedah. Which fundamentally means, is that there was an understanding. It wasn't like his dad went psycho and grabbed him and wanted to do violence to him and then chickened out. Well, then you're right. Then that kind of person, you want to stay the hell heck away from. He understood it. Obviously, there's we don't have all the conversations, but there were, we can well assume there were many conversations that Yitzchak had with his father about the whole Akedah event. The Torah does not share that with us because it's not here to, it tells us the lessons that are critical. So he had a context of meaning to be able to understand his father. And as Taryn pointed out, to continue to look up to his father, to even aspire to be Avram-esque, if you will. So that's a very big difference. Okay, this is the parsha of interesting relationships, of parent, father-son relationships. Let's go again to the next episode. Okay, let's read on with the story here. Let me have... all right, Sean, read out the parsha here. 9 sentences.
All right. This is the history of the generations of Yitzhak, Avraham's son. Avraham fathered Yitzhak. Yitzhak was 40 years old when he took Rivka, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Syrian, to be his wife. Yitzhak entreated Hashem for his wife because she was barren. Hashem was entreated by him, and Rivka, his wife, conceived. The children struggled together within her. She said, "If it be so, why do I live?" She went to inquire of Hashem. Hashem said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples will be separated from your body. The one people will be stronger than the other people. The elder will serve the younger. When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red all over, like a hairy garment. They named him Esau. After that, his brother came out, and his hand had hold on Esau's heel. He was named Yaakov. Yitzhak was 60 years old when she bore them. The boys grew. Esau was a skillful hunter, a man in the field. Yaakov was a wholesome man, living in tents. Now Yitzhak loved Esau because there was hunting in his mouth. Rivka loved Yaakov.
Okay. All right, so there's a lot of elements to the story here. Okay, so the Torah tells a lot of stuff here. What would you say are the distinction differences between Yaakov and Esau, Jacob and Esau? What kind of personality Esau, are they?
Well, Esau sounds much more agricultural and much, you know, he's an aggressive person. And Yaakov apparently just sits in a tent all day.
So obviously that's kind of weird. What is it? You know, what's up with that?
I feel like one's extroverted and one's introverted.
Well, that's certainly the case. One is because Esau, who's out there as a hunter, man of the field, he's like a man of. But in order to be a hunter, you have to be understanding of how animals operate, and you can trap them. And your man, so he's a much more extrovert in the world kind of person. Esau is Yaakov is a wholesome person living in tents. It means he's like, the Medrash says, what tents was he in? The tents of Shem and Aver. In other words, he was in like a yeshiva. He was like involved in study. So, So,
can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is there a reason why Asa is described as red all over, like a hairy garment, and Yaakov is, there's not a physical description of him?
That's good. Later on in the parsha, Yaakov says, you know, Asa is hairy and I'm smooth. So, no, that's relevant for the later part of the story.
Oh, okay.
That's in part of that when he teams up with his mother, Rivka, to deceive their Yitzchak about the blessing, how Esav is, and being a very hairy guy, is a critical fact for the story.
Okay.
Now, so there's interesting Rashi here. Now it says, now let's focus on it. Now let's talk about, it's very weird the Torah has to tell you about the love, about who loves whom. In other words, why don't you say that parents love kids and you don't have to mention that? Now, first of all, clearly we have favorites. So I ask the question to everybody. Do parents have favorites, Scott?
They do, but they're not supposed to.
That's interesting. Is that something you can control?
No, of course not. No, you can't. You have no control over that.
So if you can't, or like, if you're going to feel more emotionally close to somebody, there's very little you can do to that. So if you have a child and you feel more emotionally bonded to that child and that you love them more, that's a natural thing. But what should you not do? And that we learn later on in the book of Bereshit.
Make it obvious?
Make it obvious is correct, right?
Yeah.
That was which one of the characters in the book of Bereshit made that mistake?
Oh, Yaakov did with Yosef.
Correct. Yaakov, our character here, later on had his son Yosef, and he made the mistake by showing favoritism. Now, he thought they're already older. It's not going to make a big difference. But apparently, you can't show who's a favorite even at age 20, at 30, ever. Because the kid's sense of a kid's love or appreciation of the parent's love is something that is forever. And that's, you can't transcend that. Not, you know, or very difficult to do so. All right. So now it says, Rivka loved Yaakov. Now, my answer is, does that mean she did not love Esav? Or it says, Yitzchak loved Esav because there was hunting in his mouth, which we have to clarify. But does that mean, and not Yaakov? What do you guys say? How would you read that sentence? Adrian,
is it like a bad translation? Like it should be like a more in there. Like they loved so and so more.
It just says Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav ki tzayed b'fiv v'rivka ohevet et Yaakov. Doesn't say the word more. Mm-hmm. Got it. The question is this Yitzchak loves Esav and doesn't love Yaakov? How would you learn it? So you want to say it means love. So did Sean? You're saying that Yitzchak loved Esav more,
right?
Also loved Yaakov,
right? I think it'd be unfathomable that he wouldn't love the other, and she wouldn't love the other. Like, as so parents, you have to love both.
So it's exclusionary. One parent loved one kid, and the other parent loved the other kid. Is that what you're saying? Is that the way you're reading it?
No, I'm reading it that they love more.
All right, so you're saying that Yitzchak loved Yaakov also,
right? Just less.
Okay. All right. Adrian, what says you?
I don't know. There's multiple ways you can read it. I think that the way it reads, it sounds as though it's exclusionary. Isaac loved Esau and Rebecca loved Jacob. Like, just the natural succession of the sentences seems to imply that Isaac didn't love Jacob.
Right. So you are correct. There are literally three ways you can read this. A, exclusionary. Yitzchak only loved Esav. Rivka only loved Yaakov. Or as the way Sean says, Yitzchak also loved Esav, or loved him more, but also loved Yaakov. Or you could say, by Esav, since there's a reason given, you could say that Yitzchak even loved Esav. But of course, love Yaakov as well. There are multiple ways of reading this very ambiguous pasuk. Let's go to Rashi, our friend. All right, let's read it out here. Who would like to read Rashi? Let me have Scott. I didn't pick on you enough, Scott, tonight. You're going to get soft.
All right, Rashi. The hunt was in his mouth. Understand this as the Targum renders it in Isaac's mouth, i.e. Isaac ate the venison he brought home. But it's...
All right, so stop right there. So according to the Unkelis, the Targum, the official Aramaic translation of the Torah, why did Yitzchak love Esav? Because he brought home the bacon, or he brought home the venison. Which will imply, but if he did not bring home the venison, he wouldn't have loved him. Okay, that's one. Second possibility, go ahead, midrashically.
But its midrashic explanation is there was hunting in Esau's mouth, meaning that he used to entrap and deceive him with his words.
Okay, so hunting, in other words, is the hunting referred to who's, the question is whose mouth? Is it Yitzchak's mouth because he's enjoying eating the hunting, the product of Esav's hunting, or Yitzchak loved Esav because hunting was mouth, because basically Esav manipulated his father into loving him. Fooled him.
It was Esau, right?
Yeah, I'm saying there's two ways to learn it. Okay, according to what Rashi's saying here. All right, All right, there's a lot of stuff here, but we only have 6 minutes left of the class. I'm going to share one idea, even though there are many ideas. All right. So, who at this stage of life, whatever, 15, 20 years old, would you imagine Yitzchak feeling a closer kinship with Esav or Yaakov? Mm-hmm.
At first glance, I would think Yaakov.
You would say Yaakov because he's, in a certain sense, more like him. It seems that he's a much more bookish, thoughtful, reflective, intellectual kind of dude, just like him.
I guess that's the assumption.
I'm saying that your assumption is on point.
When it mentions tense, that means he's like studying and like.
The Targum says the tense of shame behavior. Yes, the tense of study. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. There are multiple ways to sort of understand this, but let's just go with this train of thought. So if that's the case, then why is he then? So therefore. So then you have a very crazy situation. So you tell me that the reason why Yitzchak now loves Esav because he's bringing home a dry steak? It's hard to imagine that the number two guy among the patriarchs is being manipulated because of meat. And as Suzanne's thinking, he shouldn't even want to have the meat. And certainly make a parenting decision based upon me. Crazy. Okay? So I'll just share Ray Mann's approach. He has two approaches, but one approach is like this. That, yes, Yitzchak is confronted with two sons. One is the more thoughtful, bookish Jacob. And the more out there in the field, hunting kind of guy, Esav. What it says, what you could read it as that Yitzchak loved Esav because there was hunting, which means that he saw that despite him not being a person who's not naturally prone to terrorist subject matter, he wanted to have a relationship with him to find him his role and place in the Jewish world. You know what I'm saying? In other words, he did not dismiss him. He did not discard him because he was not naturally prone to study and introspection like him. And rather, he loved him, or he also loved him because he had a role, because he perhaps later on, one thought being is that Yitzchak envisioned that there would be a partnership. You would have Yaakov being sort of like sharing the moral philosophical values, and having his son Esav sort of run the practical side of the government, of the family, of the tribe, of the nation. You know what I'm saying? Sort of a dual partnership of them working together. Now, unfortunately, that worked out to be not the case. But what the learning is like this is that we see that not only Yitzchak, but also his father Avram, looked at each person. Avram looked at Ishmael until God said, no, it's not going to happen. And Yitzchak looked at Esav as being an important member of the Jewish people. And there's an important lesson in that, is that the Jewish people is composed of many different people with many different talents and many different strengths and many different weaknesses. And you see that Avram, who was the father of all nations, is a person who embraced everybody and felt that there's an important role for everybody. Sort of echoing the sentiment, God does not make mistakes. If he's made for a reason. And the question is, what can we bring out of his strength and his capacity and his resources and his contribution and build him from there? So despite him being a hunter, which sounds like a vicious tyrant warrior kind of personality, Yitzchak sent in motion the train to be able to find a way to harness Esav's unbelievable talents of leadership, of practical wisdom, to build it into the nascent Jewish people. Now he's at the end of the parsha. He's told that's not to be from the whole episode later on. But initially, you see from Yitzchak's sentiment that really, he wanted to have a place for everybody around the table, not just the quote-unquote the Talmud Chacham, the Torah scholar. He's the real Jew, and everybody else is a loser. No. Yitzchak also showed love and embraced Esav, despite the fact of him not being, quote-unquote, the natural, quote-unquote, what you would envision as the super Jew. And not only that, he's following in the footsteps of his father, Avram, who also embraced Yishmael, until he's told by God, no, he's not. He can't bring them both up together. But until that point, he was fully 100% committed to raising both children, Yitzchak and Yishmael, in the same way Esav and Yaakov, and to find their role in the nation of Israel. And that's a very important point. In other words, not everybody's the same. Not everybody's given the same talents. But you see from the Avot that they had a mentality to figure out a way to work with everybody's given strength. And that's really what a father is. A father is a role model. A father is a person who teaches the children, but teaches the children based upon their strengths and capacities, and not tries to change them into something they're not. And that's important when you deal with children, or you'll have your own children, or you're dealing with other people, is to have sort of a respect and sensitivity to understand that the Jewish people have everybody is needed. Everybody has a role, not just the great Torah scholar. Yeah, the Torah scholar, of course, is important, but he's not only important. And there's a place for everybody around the table. And you see that Yitzchak fully embraced and showed love, maybe even more love, to Esau. Is that clear? Questions? All right. All right, there are other ideas here. It's a very rich parsha, but and I can recommend you guys check out some of the other class we did on this parsha to uncover some of the other aspects. It's a very rich parsha. There's so much stuff here. All right, guys, have yourself a great night, and I'll see many of you tomorrow night.
Thank you. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night.